At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
On the program today, we will do some housing. We'll do a little bit of bank lending. And then pickleball from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 11th day of April. Good, as always, to have you along. Everybody, let's talk real estate, shall we? Housing. Prices are still going up more slowly than they have been, but still up. Mortgage rates, same. There have been some swings, but a 30-year fixed is bumping up against 7% again. And given that, you might say to yourself, forget buying. It's just rent. Oh, were it only that simple. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on it.
You know what a lot of people do when mortgage rates are too high to buy?
They'll stay in the rental market longer.
Andrew Justice is a housing policy analyst at the Niskanen Center.
So if existing renters stay and new renters keep coming, the only thing that can change is price.
The rent goes up.
And it makes it harder for everyone to afford their rent from month to month.
Some analysts question this theory because it doesn't change the overall supply of homes and unbought homes can be converted to rentals. But Logan Modishami, lead analyst for Housing Wire, says if ever there was a year where people were trapped into renting, it was last year.
We had the biggest mortgage rate spike in recent modern day history. So definitely there were some first-time home buyers that were renters that, you know, just say, hey, listen, I can't even afford to buy a house at 7% mortgage rates.
But despite all those trapped renters, we see rent inflation coming down. One reason is that supply has come to the rescue a little bit.
New construction of rental housing, particularly multifamily housing, has really been booming over the last 6 months.
Lisa Sturtevant is chief economist with Bright MLS, a real estate data company in the Mid-Atlantic.
So in many markets, there's actually a lot more rental options now than there were even just a year ago.
A lot of those options are projects that were started in the low interest rate era before the pandemic. They were put on hold because of COVID and supply chain problems. So does this herald a new future of abundant housing supply for renters and buyers alike? No, it does not.
We do need more supply of housing.
Dean Baker is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Today's high interest rates make it more expensive for builders to build tomorrow's homes.
No doubt about it. If we see these high rates continue for another year, 2 years, it will be felt in terms of less supply of housing.
So the housing market of tomorrow won't have enough homes, just like the housing market of today and yesterday and before the pandemic. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, three little letters, gang, C, P, and I. March inflation comes out tomorrow, so traders kind of kept their powder dry on this Tuesday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. got a series we're doing about unsung economic indicators, important but perhaps less well-known tidbits of information. Today, a data set that doesn't get a whole lot of love on this program or in too many other places, to be honest, but it is one that the Fed and keen observers are going to be keeping an eye on this time around. It is, I should warn you, a mouthful, the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey on Bank Lending Practices. Let me give it to you one more time for the people in the back. The Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey on Bank Lending Practices.
I think now, yes, it's something that I'm going to look at.
I can only imagine what would be stated in there.
Kara McDaniel's at Arizona State. Kent Belasco is at Marquette. We're talking about a Fed survey that goes out to senior loan officers at give or take 100 banks across the country, usually quarterly, asking things like, over the past 3 months, how has demand for commercial and industrial loans changed? Same question for mortgages. Also, have your bank's standards for approving credit card applications changed? There's also each survey special questions of, and this is a quote, timely interest. And you think about SVB and Credit Suisse from a couple of weeks ago and the general banking agita right now, and we are for sure in a period of timely interest.
I don't know until I read this report what our lenders at these banks thinking going forward.
We need to know what lenders at these banks are thinking because this whole economy runs on credit, on lending and loans. The economy runs on it. Those banks run on it. And that is where Kent Belasco has got some experience.
Yes, about 37 years.
So when he sees the central bank raise the federal funds rate, that's the main interest rate it controls, right? The federal funds rate has gone from zero to basically 5% in a year. Belasco knows what's going to happen.
The more they increase the interest rate, it's going to make getting credit much, much tougher. Businesses aren't going to take out loans. Consumers are going to kind of start to pull in.
Fewer loans, so in theory.
Then you can start to see inflation coming down.
For the last quarter of 2022, this is according to the survey that came out this past January, banks reported tighter standards for all sorts of loans and weaker demand that they expect to continue into this year. Basically, things were going pretty much the way everybody thought they would, given the Fed's 9 consecutive interest rate hikes. And then things started going very much not the way everybody thought they would after Silicon Valley Bank and Signature.
I would say they're isolated circumstances, but it does have an impact on the banking industry as a whole.
And a bank may be a little more careful about extending credits if they're concerned that their deposit base isn't stable, and those banks may then make fewer loans.
Fewer loans after SVB would mean even tighter credit conditions than the Fed was expecting, and so even more economic slowing.
This is where people talk about long and variable legs to monetary policy. The variable part is the unexpected part. There's things that this tightening of monetary policy is going to uncover that we weren't really aware of before.
And one of the places those variable things are going to show up is in the Federal Reserve's Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey on Bank Lending Practices, the next release of which is expected later on this month. Just because you can never have too many rebrandings. Tomorrow, Warner Brothers Discovery is set to reveal its new, but not really new, streaming service. What was once called HBO Max is now going to be called Max, so reports the New York Times. But beyond the name change will also come some content changes. There will still be the biggies, of course, like Succession and The Last of Us, but also what you might call lighter reality TV. Shows like, and I'm not making this up, Dr. Pimple Popper and House Hunters International. The kinds of shows you might put on in the background while you're doing chores or paying your bills or, you know, working. There is, it turns out, a phrase for shows like that, ambient streaming. Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
I'll confess, I'll sometimes put a show on in the background while I'm, say, frantically emailing streaming experts for interviews. It usually goes something like this.
All right, let's see what we got here. Black Mirror, my favorite. Bit too intense. There we go.
Hello, bakers. Welcome to the tents.
I'm actually not a huge Great British Baking Show guy, but that's exactly the type of show we watch while, wait, why do we put it on if we're not paying attention? Shira Gabriel is a psychology professor at SUNY Buffalo. She says it goes back to our hunter-gathering days.
Our ancestors were the ones who lived together with other people, who needed other people and were in collectives. And so we evolved a primitive mechanism that pushes us towards feeling connected to others.
In other words, somewhere deep in the recesses of our caveman brains, we think the sound of the Real Housewives' voices will keep us from being eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. And certain shows scratch that evolutionary itch better than others.
A repeated narrative structure, like something like House Hunters, where there are different people every time, but we sort of know these characters, right?
Sitcom reruns work well as ambient TV, but the problem for streamers is that the Seinfeld or Fresh Prince catalog could be very expensive. NYU business professor Charles Schrager says you might subscribe to a streaming service for the prestige dramas, like Succession, but the ambient streaming library is meant to keep you from unsubscribing as soon as Succession ends.
How do you keep that subscriber engaged enough so that she won't press a button to cancel the $10 a month that she has to pay for next month?
I know I may be biased here, but you know what doesn't cost $10 a month that you can play in the background while you're doing chores? The radio. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And there's a bit of a tennis pickleball rivalry in some communities.
Do not mess with pickleballers. I'm just saying. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 98 points today, 0.3%, 33,684. The NASDAQ down 52 points, about 0.4%, 12,031. S&P 500 barely moved, down about 0.1%, 41.8 there. Matt Levin was just talking about the ambient TV trend, so about some streamers, huh? Warner Brothers stock dipped 3% today. The Walt Disney Company also down 0.4%. Netflix slid 0.2%. Tupperware says there is substantial doubt that it can continue as a business. The company has warned in a regulatory filing it may not be able to produce an annual report for 2022. After a huge dip yesterday, Tupperware stock inched back up 0.4% today, but one share will cost you $1.30. So, you know, go crazy. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There have been reports this week that the White House is getting set to roll out new rules about car and truck emissions, the net effect of which would be to get more American drivers into more electric vehicles. While we wait for that, though, there is data out today about how we're feeling EV-wise. A new poll from the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, and the University of Chicago that shows about 4 in 10 Americans are at least somewhat likely to go electric the next time they buy a car. However, it also shows that the big EV barrier for most people is the sticker price. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Driving an electric car is cheaper than driving a gas car. And Sam Ori at the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago says that is a big motivator.
74% of Americans say that saving money on gas is the top reason why they would consider purchasing an electric vehicle.
Saving the climate is also a big motivator, but not as big as saving money.
At the same time, it's not just about the operating costs. There's also the upfront costs. And we know that electric vehicles tend to be a few thousand dollars more than their comparable gasoline vehicle.
And that is the top deterrent for potential buyers. The federal government has been trying to make the sticker price less of a deterrent by offering tax credits on certain EVs.
Right now, that's $7,500. But by next week, April 18th, it's going to probably be going down for most electric vehicles to about half of that.
Leah Stokes at UC Santa Barbara says that's because of new requirements around where EVs and their batteries are made.
So a lot of the EVs are not going to qualify for that full tax credit quite yet because they don't make all the battery components here in the United States.
That should change as more car makers open EV and battery plants in the U.S., says Gil Tal at the Electric Vehicle Research Center at UC Davis.
The idea is that this kind of requirement will change where the car companies decide to build their next factory.
Ultimately, Sam Fiorani at Auto Forecast Solutions says what will really drive the cost of EVs down, more than tax credits, is more supply.
It's just going to take a while. We've been building internal combustion engines for 140 years, and so we've only been building modern electric vehicles for 20.
So right now, he says, car makers just aren't able to churn out nearly as many EVs as they can gas-powered cars. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
It was a high of 66 degrees today in Winooski, Vermont. Cloudy, a little breezy, but nice overall. Not that many weeks ago, though, those relatively balmy temperatures across much of the Northeast were switching off with days and nights below freezing. Freeze-thaw cycles, they're called, that are happening more often and earlier in the winter, too, as the climate changes. There's more precipitation as well, which is pretty much the perfect recipe for a springtime full of potholes. From our Public Works desk, Marketplace's Henry Epp has more.
On an overcast April day, Jason Benjamin and a crew of 4 Winooski, Vermont Public Works employees swoop in and get to work on East Spring Street. One uses a leaf blower to clear debris and water from potholes. Others shovel heated asphalt from the back of a truck into the trouble spots, then tamp it down. Normally, they'd use a machine to flatten the asphalt, Benjamin says, but it's having some trouble today, so they're tamping by hand.
Doesn't do as good of a job, but it still lasts quite a while. Just not as efficient.
Harder for you guys.
It is harder for us, yes. I am sweating.
This is just a temporary fix, Benjamin says, to keep the roads safe for drivers in the short term. The crew will come back in the summer to make a more permanent repair. After a relatively warm, wet winter this year, they're doing a lot of this kind of work.
It didn't freeze as good this year, and we've had a lot of wet snows, and the roads have opened up quite a bit this year. So we've got a lot of potholes we've been dealing with.
Pavements are designed to be dry. That's the whole reason why we have pavements, is to protect that soft underlying natural material.
That's Joe Sias, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of New Hampshire. She says that underlying natural material gets wet when pavement starts to crack. And when the temperature drops and that water freezes,
it'll expand, freeze, crack things more, and it's kind of a downward spiral.
The crack gets bigger, the underlying material gets softer, cars and trucks run over it.
And then you start getting those chunks that fall out.
Now you've got a pothole, and the short-term solution is to do what Jason Benjamin and his crew do, fill it in. Recently, that's been happening more often, says the city's public works director, John Rauscher.
The amount of potholes has gone up. Our budget necessarily hasn't gone up to address those, unfortunately.
And Rauscher says his department has had to do temporary pothole repairs earlier in the winter because those freeze-thaw cycles are happening earlier in the season, like in January and February. And Vermont is getting wetter. Annual precipitation has increased 21% since 1900, and more of that is falling as rain rather than snow in the winter. Meanwhile, Rauscher says the price of asphalt shot up in the last few years, too.
So that obviously limits how much paving we can do for the season.
He's competing for the same property tax money as other city departments.
You got to fund the police cars. You got to fund the fire trucks.
So Winooski's backlog of road repairs is growing, and the city is not alone. According to a 2021 report from the American Society of Civil Engineers, the country as a whole has a $435 billion road repair backlog. So what's a municipal public works department to do? For one, Joe Sias, the UNH professor, says they should start using future climate projections rather than past data when planning paving projects.
Current practice is typically to just say, oh, yeah, this is what the climate was the last 20 years. This is what we should design for, rather than, okay, next 20 years could be different in some respects.
Two, don't just fix the pothole when one forms, Sias says. Pay attention to the root causes, things like drainage issues or cracks in the asphalt.
It's like changing the oil in your car, right? If you don't change the oil in your car, you're going to have bigger issues down the road. But if you do that maintenance, you're expecting that to last longer. Pavements are exactly the same.
They're not perfect fixes, but they could help cut down on the time crews spend tamping asphalt into potholes. In Winooski, Vermont, I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Okay, pickleball. It is, according to the Association of Pickleball Professionals, so yes, that is Big Pickle's trade group, it's the fastest growing sport in the country. More than 36 million people played during the 12 months that ended last summer. And if you've driven by your local park of late, you've probably seen pickleball in action, a combination of ping pong and badminton, a little bit of tennis too. But with that popularity comes a challenge, literally finding enough places to play, which makes the challenge for city parks and rec departments a balancing act between investing in pickleball and investing in everything else that people want to do. Gabby Galvin wrote about pickleball and infrastructure for Smart Cities Dive. Gabby, thanks for coming on.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Look, I learned something in this piece, that pickleball was actually established in 1965 is when it was invented. But it does seem like only in the past, like 5 years that it's really kind of taken off. What has happened that has made it so popular?
Yeah, it's really grown, hasn't it? Pickleball got very popular during the pandemic among people who were looking for a reason to go outside, looking for something new to do. It's really easy to pick up. It's really social. So it's very popular among families. It really took off. It's actually now considered the country's fastest growing sport.
And as such, it needs places to be played. And this is happening in my little town in the Los Angeles foothills. It's happening in big cities. There just aren't enough courts to go around. And so it has become an infrastructure problem.
Exactly. I mean, pickleball players are pretty passionate. And there's a bit of a tennis pickleball rivalry in some communities because they're played on the same courts. So local officials are trying to grapple with how to like meet that demand for pickleball courts while not, you know, disrupting other recreational athletes or other people who are trying to get out. And I mean, even in the country's 100 largest cities, the number of pickleball courts is up to 2090, up from 420 just 5 years ago. So it's really been a big issue.
Can we talk equity here for a second? Because there are lots of cities in this country without enough parks to begin with, let alone pickleball. And now cities are thinking about adding new parks in areas that maybe there would be better served doing something else.
Yes. I mean, if you take a step back from this issue and remove pickleball itself from the picture, at the heart of the trend is really questions around how cities, specifically local parks departments, are allocating their resources and, you know, where that attention and investment is going. And so that is where the kind of questions around equity and access come in. You know, the solution is not that every neighborhood gets a pickleball court, because not everybody wants one. So it does become a big infrastructure question, as you alluded to.
So what are cities doing? I mean, how do they make the right decision here? Because you got to put a park in a place that people are going to use, and not all places want to play pickleball.
Cities are, you know, trying to balance those kind of short-term demand while also kind of thinking about their longer-term needs. Neighborhoods are changing and evolving all the time, and so they want to make sure that the investments are going somewhere where they're going to be used, right, you know, not just for the next couple of years, but longer-term.
Right.
So they're doing things like converting tennis courts into dual-use courts. There are some neighborhoods which have maybe some dilapidated tennis courts are being rehabilitated into pickleball courts. And then they're also thinking about their longer term plans. You know, when a city is planning a new park or a new development, they're trying to decide, okay, do we put pickleball here? Do we focus on other needs that they have, you know, trying to take a longer term view?
Yeah. All right, here's a $64,000 question. Do you play, and are you any good?
I do not play, but reporting this story got me very interested, actually. Uh-huh. So I might have to pick it up.
Aha. Uh-huh. All right. Well, we'll call you back. We'll see how you did. How about that?
Deal.
Gabby Galvin, writing about pickleball, most recently for Smart Cities Dive. Gabby, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, and it may well be that I am burying the macroeconomic lead, but there was a new world economic outlook delivered by the International Monetary Fund this morning. The actual data points aren't really the important part. The IMF says global growth is expected to be just a touch lower this year than it had been guessing in January, 2.8% this time versus the earlier guess of 2.9%. Here, though, is the meat of it. The IMF says 5 years from now, global growth is going to be somewhere around 3%, which sounds okay until I tell you that's the lowest medium-term growth forecast from the IMF in more than 30 years. It's also worth a not completely reassuring observation here that the IMF also says that all of the above assumes, and this is a quote, the recent financial sector stresses are contained. All right, we're going, but here's your moment of economic context from the Inflation is Everywhere file, and this might be a little awkward given what you just heard, but assuming regulators approve, the United States Postal Service, an advertiser on this program, is going to bump up the cost of a first-class stamp from 63 to 66 cents, effective July the 9th. That is, in case you're wondering, a 32% increase in first-class postage since 2019. Fed's got to raise rates, am I right? Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mieted, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On-Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.